market structure, and really freedom for producers, freedom for consumers in a market context. And so we're forever talking about competition, about consumer choice. When we get to the government area, we want to really emphasize transparency and accountability, and really, I guess in a way, we see ourselves to some degree as watchdogs, but we also see ourselves as people that are interested in arming other people with information, with analysis, with perspective, whether they happen to be taxpayers or students or people interested in healthcare. Whatever it is, we think information is very, very important. It's a starting point for debate and discussion, and certainly in terms of encouraging personal freedom, you need that information to take action yourself to try to change the world.
I would say there's sort of two ways that the Institute is actually explicitly active in terms of promoting freedom or liberty, and that's freedom of association. We're a private group. We voluntarily come together. We speak out freedom of speech. And I think if, unless you exercise those freedoms, well, there's every chance that they get nibbled away at and taken away, etc. So in no way are we shy, and I think people probably recognize that at the Institute. And the thing we prize most, I would argue, is our independence. And that comes out in a whole number of ways. A lot of folks say, no, you're the voice of big business, you've got a corporate agenda, you're trying to destroy the world in the name of capitalism and profitability and whatever. And actually, in terms of our funding, people are actually quite surprised to hear that only about a quarter or so of our money comes from companies or associations. And in fact, most of it's from charitable foundations, and a lot of it comes from individuals. And we're up to about 4,000 or 5,000 members now in total. The other way of securing independence with regard to money, and I mean, you need money to do anything these days. You need resources, and so we can't ignore that factor, is we avoid all government grants. And on the private sector side, we also avoid writing contracts with people, so we don't do any contract research. And so if you looked at the Institute as a think tank, as a place that desires financial independence, almost 100% of our funds come from donations. And so we've got, in a sense, a market test. We've got to be relevant to people. We've got to keep going back to them and saying, you know, do you still think it's important to support us? Especially when a lot of what we do is rather general, and it's in the nature of charitable work, good for society, not necessarily good for you directly in terms of your direct personal or corporate interest. We're also independent in terms of research, and this you may not know, but we have sort of research silos in the Institute, and we have a management committee structure, and on that management committee are about 10 researchers, each one of them dedicated to a different area, whether it's healthcare, education, fiscal affairs, or whatever, and they basically decide their own research approach. And there is a bit of a peer review internally, but we try to keep our trustees, our funders, and really everybody away from that research strategy, which doesn't mean that you can wander off and do exactly what you want. But there is this sort of an independence there which allows people to actually look at that information and tell the truth, which is sometimes hard these days when you have to go off and face that media crowd. The last point on independence is how we do our work, measurement. That's the starting point. There's a motto at the Institute, if it matters, measure it. And so we're really big on numbers, on facts, on building economic analysis on that factual content. Of course, often that's not nearly what you need to convince people. I know that directly in a lot of the debates I get involved in, and I'll give you an example from auto insurance where I've done some research. A guy named Bruce Cran, who's with the Consumers Association of Canada, which is a misnomer if there was ever one. Couldn't think of a more anti-consumer group than this than the one this character's involved with. But you get into a debate with him, you say, well, your numbers are all garbage. So that's sort of the end of the discussion for him, and now let's nationalize the industry and bring the government in and do the rest. Now the surprising thing, or the thing he doesn't understand is when we talk about those numbers, well, what do you know, they come from the annual reports of the government-owned auto insurers. So I guess if the numbers are wrong, you've got to explain why these government bodies are actually putting out misinformation, which I also know that they do, but that's another issue altogether. So, in terms of promoting liberty, of being an activist organization, we're exercising our freedom of association and speech, and we think it's awfully important to be independent, and I hope we present ourselves as an independent body. Well, that's sort of a pretty general preamble. If I ran through the various Fraser Institute programs, which I'll do just for a minute here, you get a sense of a think tank that does some deep thinking, but I think a lot more active work, and in fact to the point of actually getting right out there and mixing up on a few issues. And I'll give you an example on the education stream of how we sort of go from ivory tower, writing books, thinking deep thoughts, kind of being relevant, but maybe not really, really relevant, to being very active at the front end. We've had a program for years on education policy. The heart of it is in fact encouraging choice. And our view is the parents should have the choice, which of course is somewhat at odds with our public system and how it's structured. So we've done all kinds of books and studies and recently brought out an index across the provinces of how much choice you actually have in the system. And then you go off and correlate that to student results and how you spend money in the educational side and how your society does, and what do you know, more choice tends to lead to better outcomes. Well, that's sort of a good starting point. That's good think tank stuff, and you kind of get some headway there. And then you get some interesting things coming out of it, which is to say that Alberta and Quebec are very free places with regard to educational choice. One sounds about right. The Quebec one, you kind of go, well, that's interesting because they're not free in a lot of other ways. But it gets people talking. The next stage of that whole program were our student report cards. And we're now in most of the places that actually do government standardized tests. We gather the student information together on reading, writing, and arithmetic for primary and secondary schools and publish it, which is now into your empowering side. You're giving parents information. You're giving principals information. You're sort of letting it out of the bag on how schools are operating, what they're producing. And you can start that very detailed public discussion. And we do it with a media partner in each province. Right now, I would argue our biggest success, communications-wise, is in Quebec, where we team up with L'Actualité magazine. And in fact, a lot of people in Quebec think it's their report, and they have their biggest selling issue of the year. They claim a million people see that magazine edition when it comes out. And there's a literal season now in Quebec of discussion about education policy. But a lot of people hate it. They hate what we do. They're totally against it. But the point is to have the discussion. Otherwise, we just carry on with the status quo. So that's a very active area now, and you're starting to move away from sort of heavy thinking into sort of getting out there and arming people. And then we've taken it one step further. And we have Children First, which is in Ontario, now looking to expand across Canada. And this is now some real heavy-duty active activity where we've got the Weston Foundation, a $14 million endowment, and we're acting as a flow-through, a manager of this program, where we're getting money into low-income families' hands to help them affect choice directly. And for those of you that don't know about the program, how it operates, it's basically a matching grant. The average independent school is about $7,000 a year. We'll match your kid up to $3,500. You find the other half somehow. And it's good for kindergarten to grade 8. We're now rolling it out to about 800 families this year and hoping to expand after that. And the average income for these folks is just over $25,000 a year. So it is getting to some very devoted parents. You can imagine the trade-offs you have to make to get your kids into these schools. Some of them are coming from the public system. Some are coming out of other independent schools. We know already we are at least affecting perceptions because we surveyed the parents and the kids how did you rate your old school? How was the involvement there? Quality of teaching, satisfaction with the coursework, blah, 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 blah. The old rating in the old school, C+. The rating all across the board now, A. Now, does that mean these kids are going to do much better in the future? Well, we don't know. We'll find out. And this is where we circle back to research, because we're now developing a panel survey of people who went in the program, and 8 years from now, or 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, we will actually be able to publish research saying, well, here's a block of people, maybe our control study or all the ones that couldn't get into the program, because we're about 20 times oversubscribed. We actually have to have a lottery in this program. And this year we didn't even do any advertising, so you can imagine the word of mouth that's out there now. And against the general population, you know, how did kids do and how did kids do in this program? We have no doubt the parents are motivated, so you've got to control for those things. But it then heads back to research, and we're back to school choice and contributing to the very research and the very activities elsewhere that happen to trigger off the work at the Institute. So that's just an example of how we sort of operate day to day. We do see ourselves, and it's got a great internal culture, as people who are interested in affecting change, extraordinarily interested in the functioning of markets and the importance of markets and how that empowers consumers, and also how it gets the right economic outcome from the producer side. And I think a lot of it is dealing with the media, trying to put it in plain English, and I would be the first to say that even myself and lots of us, it's hard to take that economic jargon and really boil it down and help people to understand what it's about. But we've done, I think, that quite successfully on the tax side with Tax Freedom Day. We've been doing that now for decades. I think we've had a huge success here, although we're not anywhere close to the right solution, on waiting lists. Going back to the mid-80s and late 80s, initiating that measurement program, getting it on the agenda, and now, of course, you know, everybody's talking about waiting lists. Everybody knows we've got waiting lists. You know, this is no longer the best healthcare system in the world. It's now totally open to discussion about reform and so on. You know, our government's going to get rid of waiting lists. Well, no, sorry. And here's where economists are helpful, because waiting lists are just a sign of rationing. And once you get that in your head, you can understand what actually needs to be done to address the issue. But I think the model we've got here, which is basically get out there, measure things, do the proper economic analysis, try to translate it into plain English, actively work with the media, and I'm quite open to people saying, well, you know, the media is biased and they're this and that. Well, you know, they're always biased. If you've got something entertaining and interesting and relevant, they can't help themselves. And certainly their competitors can't help themselves, which forces them to then look at the issue. So rather than go through a whole list of all the things we do, I think you're probably familiar with a lot of it. Maybe I can kind of bring these opening remarks to a close. I know I haven't provoked too many of you with you know, controversial things to really get you worked up, but I personally would benefit from your feedback, your impressions of the Institute, if you've got a view on it, ideas you've got for research we might do, and where the thing might head. And I'd be very, very open to any comments that people have. So here's your big chance, Jim.
Maybe you should mention something about your website and your
emailing. Sure. Yeah, sure. We've actually got a number of websites. All of them can be found at FraserInstitute.ca. And we put up all our research now. We're going ever more electronic. In fact, we may have gone a little too far. It's hard to tell. I think people still like paper in front of them. And I know a lot of people read the Fraser Forum, which is our regular monthly that goes out. And that's it's something tangible about paper and nice color covers and so on. So we've got to make sure we're keeping people running with us. But certainly for the media, it doesn't matter now whether it's electronic or printed. They don't read the whole thing anyway. So I have believed this since I came into the Institute. I believe it now. What we actually publish, what most people read, is that column inch in the newspaper, and therefore our press release is our primary product.
which is pretty frightening, really. But, you know, behind that, the thick book, the monograph, you know, the research that's been put into it, the citations, and there's a credibility thing in behind. But on the Fraser Institute Insight, or website, rather, you'll see links to the other ones. FreeTheWorld.org, which is our international side. Economic Freedom Network, we put this together years back. We now have about 70 members in 70 countries. And we collectively publish the Economic Freedom of the World every year and are going ever more deeply into that area. Just a real recent success for us. We're liaising with a group in Oman on economic freedom in the Arab countries. And we think that's a really important area to get people thinking about sustainability and security and getting those societies moving forward in a different way than you would if you were, you know, trying to sort of get Iraq sorted out and get people to stop putting off the bombs and so on. You know, if Huntington and other people are right, it's basically alienated, disaffected young males that are behind a lot of this, then let's get them jobs, please. Because that's a real good way to buy into society and take the temptation to destroy away from them and rather create things. So we've had some success there in the last year or two. We've recently had a Templeton grant of $500,000 bucks, and we're going to be doing a lot more work in the Arab world in the next few years. You know, is it going to bear fruit? Are they going to, you know, sort of hug each other and move on and create a constructive society? And so, well, you know, let's get going. But having said all that, you know, who really thought that the Berlin Wall was going to come down the way it did, and that we would have only, well, it's only 15 years on now, the kind of societies developing there that we do. So, you know, things can dramatically change, and we understand here, all of us, what people fundamentally want, even in those countries, and what they can't get. So that's freetheworld.org. Children First has a website as well, and then CanStats is our other one, where we're putting up regular commentary, trying to talk directly to the media about good science, good data, getting the facts sorted out on a lot of current issues. Yeah, I actually know less about that, and I guess I should. Suzanne Walters is our communications person. I guess we've got a regular distribution. I mean, I know we've got all kinds of distribution lists, and we have various products that go out there, but, you know, write to us, give us your email. We would be delighted to flood you with stuff. And again, sometimes we overdo it, but I guess if people are keen, then why not give them the information?
There's actually a sign-up for that on the website.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I have two questions, if I may, on education policy.
Yeah.
One, I just wanted you to comment on, I used that Fraser Institute report on, or many actually, on education policy for a paper that I wrote this year. And whenever you mentioned that students, or rather parents, rank their new schools as like A-plus versus C-plus,
yeah.
One of my profs brought up an interesting point that it's a psychological fact that whenever you make a choice, you tend to want to support it. Therefore, you've made the choice to give it a better grade. So,
yeah.
I'm wondering if you can comment on that.
Yeah.
Oh, super biased, but
yeah.
I mean, it is a legitimate argument. Then.
Oh, sure. No, that's a fair comment. And in fact, I was chatting with one of our trustees the other day about the program. I said, to give the choice is sufficient for that program, period. I don't care if they've got a biased opinion about it. Like, just to have a choice, to have the income to motivate the financial side of it, for me anyway, is enough success for that. And great, you know, I'm convinced, and we're not going to cook the results or anything, but I'm convinced we'll find exceptional student performance. I mean, these are families that are entirely devoted to education. I mean, what else would you expect? So that's a fair, entirely fair comment, but I'd even step one step back from that, just say that the very existence of the program, just by operating it, is already moving us miles down the road. And one hopes that you'll see the same impact as in other jurisdictions, where when you expand choice and when you show that other example and talk about it and get it out there, that you actually improve the public system and get it reacting, as you would expect in a competitive situation.
Yeah,
That's a fair comment.
Well, I don't need an economic justification anyway. I'm just trying to, you know, get smarter
sure.
because I
yeah.
think public education is evil anyway. But getting off that, though, I was wondering, has anybody ever thought of doing a study on the macroeconomic implications of shifting some of the burden of public education towards individual payment? Like, if you have more private education, you have less taxes on it. Therefore,
right.
you're shifting some of the onus onto people rather than through taxes. So I was wondering if
yeah.
you've ever
yeah.
thought about, you know, studying the dynamics of that for the overall economy.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You're going one step past vouchers, I guess. Eh? You're saying
yeah.
it's a great thing to stop funding the school and start funding the student, but go even one step further and just
yeah.
stop the funding period. Is that the basic
well,
point?
I mean, at least a certain portion. I mean, there are many people who are wealthy enough to afford to get out of the public
sure.
education system and not have
yeah.
to pay taxes for it.
Yeah.
Which they do anyway.
Yeah. I think the constraint on a study like that is it's been so limited.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sure you can do the study.
Yeah.
And it's like any of those other industrial impact studies. You know, you're going to come up with some 0.00 something percent of GDP. And it's just not going to be an impressive number. The bigger issue, I think, is the quality of the education. And it's like an opportunity cost thing. Here's where we were heading, and now we've got this better structured system that's actually reflecting what people want and what they need, and it's producing better citizens and you know, literally more human capital. What's that worth? And I know the Bank of Canada actually has had a program on for about probably 10 or 20 years, actually, trying to measure human capital. This would be a subset of that, and they come to the not startling conclusion that people are rather important in the economy. One of our primary inputs. So please, we have smarter ones that are working in the right context. But to your suggestion, I think it would be a difficult study, and I just, you know, back to sort of media attractiveness, the number you would come up with would just, they'd go, okay, well, that's, you know, who cares? I think that would be the reaction. Say it again, sorry.
They're probably trying to determine the appropriate level of taxation on human capital.
I'm sure the Bank of Canada is not doing that, but that's the appropriate question, or one of the appropriate questions. I can tell you one area I want to get more involved in at the Institute, and I think we're already down that road, which is related to this, is size of government. And I would say you can kind of put up what are victories here and what are defeats. We are getting tromped right now on the size of government side. I mean, we are getting our asses kicked, and it isn't funny. And I think Terry Corcoran has some very wise things to say about this fetish about deficit, no deficit, balanced budget, and then stop thinking about the issue, which is just an excuse to spend more money. And so we've had work out on value for money. We're going to have more work out. I had a paper out on Gomery a few months ago. When he brings his report out in November, we've got about two or three other pieces planned. And you're going to see, I think, over the next little while, and I'm determined over the next few years, a lot more discussion about sort of waste inefficiency and a better way of doing things. Little factoid, if you ask people anywhere, Germany, U.S., Canada, anywhere you want to pick, how much money does government waste? The typical answer is 40%, which may not be actually the right number, but that just gives you a sense of mentally where people are at. And I think generally just a sense of hopelessness that it'll ever be tackled. So it's an untapped interest in the topic, I think, and I hope we're going to do more work there.
I have a question about the education, going back to that. I'm a fan of private education, but I think one of the main arguments against the program that you run would be that you're taking, rather than dealing with the problem that educates the mass majority of people,
mm-hmm.
you're just plucking a few, and that's wonderful, but you're plucking a few of them out and giving the opportunity and then letting this just get worse.
Yeah.
And there's nothing being done to... I don't really think it's evil, but I think that it probably doesn't do the job. It definitely doesn't do the job that it should.
Yeah.
And I think that perhaps a better idea would be to bring this up rather than just to take this over here.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, the idea is to move everybody over there.
Well, no. And it's not all of one and none of the other. I mean, you know, what I like about Children First, and this is one of my favorite programs when I came in, it's entirely private. 100%. Private capital, private initiative, private organization, private people all making private decisions. It's got nothing to do with government. And of course, it was, by coincidence, more or less structured the same way as the provincial tax credit that was done in under, well, first under Eves and then wholly killed off under McGuinty. You know, it does the same thing, but it does it entirely through private channels. But, you know, we're just getting going here. And I should say, to date, our effort on the report cards has been almost entirely descriptive. We have spent our time getting them up and running and publicizing them and just getting the raw material out. We really honestly haven't done much research. And I know Mike Walker is very interested, and so is Peter Cowley, who's in that area, in actually starting to do the work on, okay, well, so what? You know, what does this say about the system and about the quality of one school next to the other? You can link all of this, by the way, through the student's postal code. You have literally every kid's postal code, and you can therefore link it to the census data. There's a treasure trove here of analytical material to get into these issues. And, of course, in a lot of places, including Ontario, a lot of the private schools actually don't take the standardized tests. So what we have actually are predominantly public schools. So when we get into that area of research, we're going to be talking, because of the nature of the data, about the public system. So I don't want to leave it with the impression that we're just kind of all focused over here on this narrow area. I think we'd all be delighted to have the public system react. And in fact, the economic or the Educational Freedom Index that Claudia Hepburn brought out was in fact on predominantly the public side. So I think I see more research there. There's been a starting period here of about 7 or 8 years. We're almost at the point now where we've got all these reports in line. Though I should tell you, you may not realize that we have no secondary school report for Ontario. Think of the millions of dollars and the effort going to that report, and it really isn't being distributed. And the problem is data quality. It is still not up to the mark here. So we've got an entire tranche of kids that are being tested in Ontario, and at least our opinion is the quality of the outcome being measured is just not up to the point where you can compare apples and apples.
This is on a very different subject.
Sure.
And moreover, it's in a sense, it's way off of your territory. But I'm just, what you said earlier made me think that people at the Fraser Institute might be able to do a bit of thinking about this. It's long seemed to me, I mean, this is in regard to the Israel-Palestine situation. One of the things that I've often thought that it would be extremely useful to do would be for somebody to figure out just how much poorer the Palestinian people are because of the violence that has been initiated in that part of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to put some numbers on it,
it seems
to me if the typical Palestinian could be told, by the way, the Intifada has cost you personally $200,000 over the last 10 years.
Sure.
That would be something that would be worth knowing. I mean,
it would
be an interesting piece of information.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that you got some of the kind of expertise that might be transmitted to somebody to get interested in a project.
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting issue. And in fact, you get into the Arab world and there's petrol money, but then you start looking at the average per capita incomes. And it gets even more shocking, when you look around the world at the places that restrict economic freedom, that don't have systems that are paying due heed to property rights and the rule of law, you know, the very, very basic fundamentals of society. They're actually going backwards. Never mind, not getting as much money as you would have otherwise. You know, I'm going to guess here, but I would guess that on average, probably the Arabs in the Palestinian area, on average, are wealthier now than they were 30 years ago, even with the situation they're in. I'm not certain they've gone backwards. That I would take into account a lot of international subsidy. But, there are countries out there that are literally going in reverse here. And that's, entirely worth noting. And then it stands out as you do the analysis, but
that basically would help to measure policy error,
yeah.
Right? Now, some people would say the error there is some kind of, evil police state, Israeli plan to subjugate their minority population and so on and so forth. But, some of that's perspective and it's really not getting at the heart of what's happening there in terms of economic economic opportunity. But that's a very good idea. That's well worth doing. And that's a general rule that would apply to lots of places in terms of, the cost of not doing the right thing. We're bringing out our annual report on economic freedom, I think September 8th, somewhere around there. And this time we've got a special article in it about conflict and economic freedom, and just getting at the point that societies that are truly free or are attempting to be freer tend not to bug their neighbors. And ones that don't have awesome temptation to go bug their neighbors. Again, back to the Arab world, the sad thing is we can't yet rank Iraq because we don't trust the numbers. And, of course, they were bugging all kinds of people and have hopefully stopped doing it, although their neighbors tend to continue to bug them. That's a very interesting idea. That would be quite worthwhile. And maybe within the context of some of our work in the Persian Gulf, we'll go after that. The back, yes.
I have two questions. One, you talk about the general world population establishing a 40% government wage. Are there any substantial figures to support that?
To actually say that they do waste 40%? I would certainly say there's huge academic support, and I mean literally hundreds of studies that you would then just sort of add up on everything from waste collection to healthcare to anything delivered by a monopoly, which is mostly what the government, how the government operates, that you've got at least 15 to 20% waste right off the top, just inefficiency. Could be far better, and that's static inefficiency. That's just we're delivering the garbage like this, and we pay our guys too much, and we take too many coffee breaks, and we're really not effective because we don't care. And now all of a sudden we have to compete, and what do you know? There's that beautiful efficiency gain that's in there, and those are areas that I could point you to many studies. There's a dynamic inefficiency, no innovation. Is the government going to invent the next great DVD technology? Are they the guys that are going to push the IT revolution further? I mean, they're the farthest way away from all the great things that capitalism and markets provide, and that's got to swamp that efficiency factor by a huge amount. There's another stream of analysis that has to do with deregulation. And you can look at the trucking industry, telecommunications, cultural industries, and going back several decades now, the heart of the industrial structure, the steel makers and the big industrial conglomerates and so on. And you will find in that research much, much higher gains. And the way that these are often measured are in terms of real price changes to the product, and then you can get into the quality of what's being produced. But you will find as a general rule with deregulation, between about 40% and 70% drops in real prices. Because of the freeing up of initiative and capital and the access to innovation in the private sector. That would be over, let's say, a 10-year kind of transition period, which I personally believe is the kind of thing we could see in Canada and all sorts of places, whether it's in the finance area or electricity or a whole number of other areas. So these are all, and I'll stop talking in a second here, but these are all sort of direct economic. What's wrong with monopolies? What's wrong with central control? What's wrong with trying to politically direct economic activities? These are the kind of numbers that pop out of there. Now, your standard sort of citizen sitting back is thinking the guy sitting in the truck drinking his coffee instead of fixing the road. And that kind of inefficiency, well, I don't know, but I'm sure we have, significant overstaffing. We absolutely 100% have overpayment. generally in the public service relative to what's produced. But we also have a very hard problem measuring output. In fact, statisticians have basically given up, and they just assume zero productivity in government. Literally, that's how we measure it, zero. It's measured by inputs. So if we hire another civil servant, that's a one-for-one into their productivity numbers. But I think I may not be answering your question, so I keep, you're trying to interrupt me, but I won't stop talking, so I'll give you a break here.
Well, in fact, unless you can measure the output, then you can't qualify as a statement made that an additional civil servant renders zero output.
Well, no, they render one unit of output. That's the way they measure it.
It's
zero increment. So if you hire somebody and pay them $50,000, that's $50,000 of new government output. That's how they measure it. Now, I can tell you, because you can get at some of this stuff, and I've done a lot of work in healthcare. I would argue there's negative productivity. They're destroying value. It's going down. We're paying more and getting less. And that's pretty frightening when healthcare is 10% of the economy. But
if that's the case, then why is it that the general population is still supportive of government?
I think the general population is married to the status quo, and so is everybody. They just kind of like where they're at right now, and aren't terribly distressed with how their life's going. And government happens to be a big part of that. So I think you got to challenge their view of what's out there and what's happening.
In terms of establishing the agenda at the Fraser Institute, how do you go about doing that? What is the process that's used internally to let the issues rise to the top?
Well, as I suggested before, we are decentralized, and so we let our individual area people kind of run with their research agenda. We are pretty nosy, and we sort of ask questions of each other. There's certainly a high level of peer review internally. There's obvious things to study. Healthcare is just, I think it's perfectly obvious. We have to do a lot of healthcare work. Within healthcare, how do you think about the issue? What exactly do you focus on? That's kind of a bit of a, you feel things out but again, it's pretty obvious. There's only two streams. There's how you pay for health and how you do it. There's financing, insurance, so there's the delivery. And then that sort of leads to how would you structure a research project and so on. But in the area of waste and inefficiency, I think this area, which I would call value for money, is a case by case, get into the gory detail and just show it as it plays out. And we've had some success so far, literally going at the Auditor General archives and going back and saying, okay, well, here's how they actually delivered the program. Here's what happened. Here's the waste of money or where they didn't meet the objectives or where the Governor General had to come back 3 times in 10 years and say the same thing over and over and over, and yet we're still not delivering what is supposed to be delivered here. And then put that in the context of public choice theory, and so people have got a conceptual way of understanding why it's happening, and then offer options for change. So I think the simple answer is be specific and sort of get to the facts and the detail. I think running around and ranting and saying, hey, 40% is too much or 50% is too much or 15% is the right, sort of structure of government, I think that's okay. But, I think you've got to be quite tangible about what the benefit is, because there's an easy way to play against this, and that is, oh, you guys are all about hacking and slashing and destroying good things. Right? That's the easy response. What are you going to take away from people? Are you going to take the home oxygen from seniors? I tell you that one because I have now hung around Queen's Park enough that this is literally true. Every time that the politicians ask for efficiencies in the health ministry, the number one suggestion coming back is home oxygen for seniors. I tell you that without any distortion. It's only about a $200 million program, and the bureaucrats know that that's about the last thing you'd ever want to put out there, and they will always come back with that program. Now, if I was the minister, that would be the first deputy minister fired at health when they came back with that suggestion, and we wouldn't hear that again. But that's just the attitude in the ministry. But So I think you've got to do it on a case-by-case basis. I think the rhetorical battle is one that
you make a lot of fire and smoke. I'm not so sure you move people. And just basic facts, you know, here's where we are. Did you realize where Tax Freedom Day is? Did you realize exactly how much the government spends? And of course, that's the heart of the 40% number, which is a perceptual response. And I'm just guessing some say half and some say a quarter, and it ends up being averaged at 40%. But I think you've got to engage them at a very specific level. Yeah.
You mentioned a while ago that you avoid government grants.
Yeah.
Well, there are real lessons to be learned from the past in liberal schools. There was a French liberal school in the Industrial Revolution that was very popular worldwide and then tried to professionalize economics, for one, into by introducing the government and its funding. And the result was that the school in its tradition collapsed. It completely failed and had far-reaching and long-lasting consequences. And there's also the temptation, the constant temptation to try to advance one's ideology by taking this money, but the consequences can be ultimately that arise from that action itself can ultimately destroy your own institution, your own ideology.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And, you know, we talk about this internally, and it's a temptation more internationally than at home, because there's a lot of government money out there, and you can think of all the international organizations. You know, we could go into any number of countries and give them advice and do analysis and so on, but you need a grant from the World Bank, or you need a grant from some other body. And to date, we've basically just ruled against it. And I think part of the thinking is a philosophical or moral one. You know, government has taken this by confiscatory means, and therefore, you know, why should we have it? But I think it's a more important, real issue, which is the one you're getting at, which is the essential conflict of interest. You know, how well are we going to be able to criticize people and really speak the truth if we've got to worry about how they reacted to Human Resources Canada or the Ministry of Education or whoever it might be? And that's also the sort of decision on the private side about contract work. And I was a consultant myself for 5 years, so my eyes are wide open on this stuff. You know, you got a client, you know what they want, and you're going to go to your way to help deliver it. That's natural. We just don't want to deliver what government wants to deliver. So so much of what we do is public policy. I think it'd be difficult. Now, again, just to tell you some real world facts here, there are discussions at the federal government level right now about the think tank world and the spectrum of opinion out there. And there are views that, you know, we're doing fine at this end, and some of the union-funded guys are doing well at the other end, but it's kind of sparse in between. And wouldn't it be a great idea if the federal government could seed these people and populate the think tank world and so on? And I just think of that as about the scariest possible idea. Who knows what the largest think tank is in Canada?
Yeah,
no, we're three times bigger.
Really?
No. We're the biggest independent. Anybody? Anybody? No. It's only a year old. Come on. It's only a year old. You must know about it.
Trudeau.
Give me a hand. It's out of Waterloo. You must have heard of it. Come on. Biggest. No. Come on. They're across the street from the perimeter. International governance. I forgot the full name of it. $60 million, folks. Staff of 50 that are bigger than us in a year.
From who?
Well, 30 from the feds and 30 from the RIM fortune through Jim Balsillie.
Oh.
Now, when you go to that organization, here's your comment writ large, and look at their advisory group, their board of governors, and so on. We actually have sitting deputy ministers from Ottawa that are on the governance structure, former federal cabinet ministers. Now,
you know, there's independent research, okay? That's where you go. Now, they got $60 million. Not bad. We got 7 a year. So, you know, I'd be kind of happy to have that. But the trade-off they've made, and they've done it willingly. I mean, they just think this is obvious. This is the way to go. But this is a way not to structure your finances. And they'll get the result that they're allowed to have, really, at the end of the day. Well, I don't know about that. Apparently, it's a very exciting place. They've got a brewery that they're converting, and they're developing software. It's kind of a fun place to be, but it's not going to change the world in a fundamental kind of way, I don't think. Yeah.
I'm from Quebec. I have 2 kids in private school. But one thing that you may want to look into is going back to your issue of government waste, a number I heard of from somebody who's in the Equality Party doing research into education is that there are more bureaucrats in the Department of Education than there are teachers.
Well, that's interesting.
Now, I don't know. This was told to me by somebody who got elected to Parliament for the Equality Party about 10 years ago. I don't know if that's true still, but certainly that bears some...
That's a neat number. And I can tell you, if again, back to value for money, if you want to appeal to people, do a head count of bureaucrats. That they always love that kind of stuff. It's very simple to explain. And we're now back up to all-time highs in many places in terms of hiring. Right. You know, with this expansion of spending the last few years, of course, they're spending it on new positions. So that would be a nice comparator as well, where you kind of are saying, well, you know, who's at the front line and who's, you know, not.
And the other problem in Quebec specifically, I don't know about the other provinces, is that the teachers union is very, very strong in Quebec. And a lot of times there are certain things the government tries to change, and the union will really force the government to backtrack. So that's something that...
Well, I'm sorry to say it's not just the union. It's also the school boards and the associations. We've actually had some problems over the past year with some of the school associations where they're unhappy with us. So, and they're making that publicly known. It's not just the unions, obviously. Yeah. Last question? Somebody that hasn't asked one, maybe? Okay, well, let me just finish. You can get me at markm@fraserinstitute.ca. Love to get ideas and commentary back. Although I'm supposed to start September 1st, I found I started several weeks ago, and it's just not ending here. But I'd be very open to any thoughts you have after this. Just send them in. And we've got a very strong organization, and I'm going to build on that. There's not going to be dramatic changes. But as far as I'm concerned, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of policy problems out there. We're never going to be out of business. So, please send in your thoughts. There's no end of bad policy. So we'll keep working away. Okay.
Yeah. 2 words. Private universities.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're actually, I'm told they're allowed in Ontario, but I don't see a lot of them forming.
They have a
fan. Yeah, yeah. No, I'd,
I know that's theoretical.
All for it. In another hat here, I'm on Roger Martin's competitiveness and productivity task force. And we have observed that one of the major problems in post-secondary is that we spend about the same as the Americans in the public system as a percent of however you want to ratio it, whether it's economy or educational effort or whatever. And then the Americans let the private sector do another 50% more.
Oh, wow.
Which, of course, is exactly the model that we do in healthcare. And in fact, now they're actually spending more than we are publicly as a share of the economy. And because they're richer than us, that dollar figure is another 20% higher. I really think of Canada as a real prohibitionist kind of society. It's like, don't do that stuff. You know, God forbid. No, take that money away. Take your expertise away. We don't want your energy and initiative. Please, please. It's bad for us. We really, really would like to do it ourselves through the government. Yeah. Please don't free us. We're just delighted with how things are going. They told us how to think, and now we're quite willing to tell you how to think. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you.